So this is June.
Yes, well, while I was working on the QE2, as I say, in running the library, it was really rough weather, and we were coming across from the UK to America, and suddenly this huge, massive, massive storm came up, almost out of nowhere. It's a very wide storm. It stretched from the north right up to Canada and way down south on the States, eastern seaboard. Because normally in a storm, the navigators can navigate around and change direction. And in this case, there was no chance. And we had to tell all the passengers that to be careful, you know, not to go out on deck. And it was in the evening. And I'm getting these stories. This 100-foot wave, yeah. And we went. I was with the staff that were mixing with the passengers, and we went into what they had like a midnight buffet, and with ice sculptures and everything like that. And all of these passengers were rushing to the buffet and picking up cheese and food and to take back to their cabins.
So were they having to be locked down then? In the cabins?
No, they were recommended to stay in their cabins, you know, and it was night. It was getting to be, it was quite late. It was about 11 o'clock at night. And, I was with a couple, the ballroom dance couple, actually, and we were sitting down trying to see what was going on and if we could help anybody. And these two ladies came across in their high heels. We told them to take off their shoes, but they had their high heels on. And they were clutching some food, and this one woman actually fell when the ship listed a bit. And so Steve rushed across to her to see if he could help, and he got her up and came back. And I said, was she okay? And he said, yes, her hand was bleeding. And he said, don't worry, it was only her diamond ring that that cut her hand. Anyway, I went to bed in my cabin, and I put everything off my bedside table into the drawer and shut that drawer. And I never, I liked stormy weather, but I never left the lights on. But in this instance, I did. And my bunk was facing so that my head was facing forward. My feet were facing the aft end of the ship, but my TV was above my bed, and the view from the bridge was on the camera. Even though it was at night time, you could see the rough waves, and it was like a back to front story, because I was looking at the ship going forward, but my head was, I was actually going backwards, if you see what I mean. And I saw this, the screen went white, and then there was this huge bang smash. And we'd hit a 100-foot wave, or the 100-foot wave had hit us, and it had damaged the foredeck, the anchor deck. And so we limped into New York, and we were there for 2 days, which was great, because we were able to get off, go and enjoy ourselves in and around the Irish pubs and things along the quayside. But it was quite damaging. The strength of the sea is just, you can't believe it. I mean, it had buckled the front deck, and I went with a friend below deck to where the anchors were stowed, and these great steel columns which were holding the decks had concaved, really bent like a twig. And so that was a very exciting story. And I don't get seasick, so I'm really lucky.
Oh, that is an amazing story. Yeah, really incredible. Yeah,
and then we hit the rocks.
Oh yeah, go on, Dave, carry on. You can carry on.
This other one was an incident when we were off Martha's Vineyard, and we were sailing away from Martha's Vineyard, and again it was in the evening, and we were heading into New York for the next day, and bearing in mind we had 1,800 passengers on board, and a woman had come and. Earlier that day, she'd come into the library and said, oh, I'd love to meet up with you for a drink this evening, she said, because I have been a librarian and I was interested in your job. And so she came into the library with her husband, and this would have been about 9:30 at night, when we made this massive banging sound, and immediately people were sort of looking around and wondering, and one of the bartenders was walking past and somebody said to him, "What's happened?" And he said, we were all trained to be sort of
until
anything was said. So he said, "Oh, we might have hit a whale or something like that, because in the past something like that has happened." But and it turned out that we'd actually hit some rocks, and we had to disembark overnight all those passengers. It took all night long. They were taken by launch onto Martha's Vineyard, which is very luxurious sort of sea place, a bit like where Rock might be, you know, where all the wealthy people lived. And these launches were taking everybody off, and they were all having to sit in the main rooms, the passengers, ready to go. And all their luggage was going to be taken off in New York. And it was just poor all night long. Maybe 12 people would be given a ticket number, and then their number would be called, and then they'd have to go down the gangway and be taken off onto the launch into the dark. And a couple of the launches couldn't quite see where they were going. They ended up in somebody's amazingly expensive lawn, you know, and parked there. But it turned out we got all the passengers off. They were very upset because they didn't get their luggage off until New York. And one man actually came to me, and he sort of said, I'm a traveling group, he said, and I'm in charge of this group of 12 people, and we're getting off in New York. And he said, you know, supposed to be getting off in New York, he said, what about our luggage? And he was really, really, really upset. And so I just sort of said, I'll just go and check, sir. And I just went round the corner, because everybody was busy. The phone lines were all down, you know, the radio was all working with Shoreside. And I just waited for 10 minutes. And then I came back and I said, I'm sorry, sir, but I have spoken to the hotel manager. And he said, not to worry, your luggage will all be off quite safely in New York. I had to say it because he was really, really upset. And anyway, they all got off safely. And then when we got to New York, we sailed on to Boston to see what the damage had been. And that was just the crew. And when we got to Boston, most of the crew were flown home, but I was left on board because I had to sort out all the library, because the ship was going to be going into a refit. And so it all had to be packed up, 8,000 books in boxes labelled, you know. And so again, though, we were in Boston for 2 weeks. We'd had a gash, I think it was 70 metres long in the hull, but it's a double hull, so fortunately it didn't go to the inner side of the ship, but it could well have been a very big disaster. But I found it, having been through that, it was quite a very interesting event.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, I don't apologise, it's amazing. Well, I didn't know that bit about the going round.
I'm June Appleby, and I live at Carnbrae, a village called Tregajoran, and I'm 84.
So then you can just...
Okay. I first came to Cornwall in the late 1959, because I had a summer job with a friend at a hotel near Newquay at Holywell Bay. The reason we came to Cornwall was the whole crowd of our friends who used to go to the coffee bars with us and the jazz clubs in Richmond said they were leaving to go to Cornwall and become bohemians and artists. So we managed to get this job at this hotel, and then on days off came into St Ives. And I eventually came back to St Ives and lived there for about a good few years. And during that time, a friend of mine in St Ives, Françoise, who was French, and she, I'm stopping now. Yes, we used to all go to the pub with the Breton fishermen that used to come over from Brittany in those days. And actually, this was now in the early 1960s and late 1950s. And these Breton fishing boats were absolutely gorgeous in Carbis Bay. They used to pull in with their rusty sails and that, and the fishermen would come into the pub, and they would bring lace with them that their wives had made. And the local fishermen in St Ives used to give them, repair their nets for them in return for lace in the pub. And they didn't speak each other's language, but they used to mix very well. Anyway, Francois, being French, one day was invited to go onto the fishing boat, the Breton fishing boat. And they set sail and they went round the coast and came up and ended up in Falmouth. And when they got to Falmouth, she wasn't allowed to come ashore because she didn't have her passport with her or any papers, and it was a French boat, and the harbour master and in Falmouth, who checked all sailors that came in, wouldn't let Françoise off the boat because she shouldn't have been there. Oh, no. And so her mother had to come all the way over from St Ives with paperwork to prove that she actually was a resident in St Ives. So I thought that was a very funny story. So little things like that used to happen, and St Ives was a great place to live. There was what was in those days a really, really good mixture of the local people, the artists, and they mixed so well. It was just a lovely time. And then later on in my life, I moved back to Surrey. And then for other reasons, I decided to come back to Cornwall again. And this was now in the early 1970s. And I came down with my three children and have been here ever since, a long, long time. And I think it's partly to do with being near water, because I grew up at a swimming pool, two swimming pools. My father was a superintendent.
Can I stop the one story and then do the second story? Is that right?
Yeah. Yes. When I first moved into the cottage at Tregajoran, which was 1978, my girls were sort of 10 and 12, something like that.
A bit younger than that,
yes. Yeah. Genevieve was under 10. And Cambrai, of course, was absolutely so exciting to be living right beside it. In fact, when I bought the cottage, before we actually got the final contract signed, I took the kids up to the top of Cambrai and we sat on the rocks and looked down at the village and could see the roof of the cottage we were going to be moving into. So that was very dramatic. And the girls used to go with their friend Pauline up Cambrai, and I made sure that they were all wearing a bright red jumper or something I could see. And if things were getting a bit later and it was going to be a bit twilighty, I'd worry if they weren't back. So we had a conch. We still got it, this big conch shell, which I'd learnt to blow. It's quite loud. And I used to go in my garden and blow the conch shell to call them back down. And I don't know if they could hear it, but they did used to turn around and come back.
That's brilliant. Oh, that's lovely.
You remember that?
That's reminded me of it. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Because I then used the conch shell later on.
Yes, you did.
Knee-high in ghost nets. Well, I did. And so I used the same conch shell, which I'd also learnt to blow. So this is Beck, June's daughter. And, I used to put it down by my feet. So I was in the Red River dressed as a half woman, half fish. And I used to blow the conch and I put it down by my foot so I could feel it. And then I'd pick it up later on. This particular show, I put the conch down by my foot, and when I went to reach to find it, it was nowhere to be seen, and I thought I'd lost it. And then actually what happened was my friend Jerry, so we looked and looked and looked, and it was nowhere near where I was standing. Anyway, my friend Jerry sat really high up on the cliff and was looking down, because the Red River used to change all the time, the mouth of the river into Gudrevi, and he was looking down and looking down. And he kept diving down. Anyway, he dived down into what was a really rough part of the river, and he discovered it. He re-found it and brought it back to me. I was like, thank God, because Mum was on the QE2 at the time, and I'd have lost a very precious family heirloom. But fortunately, Jerry found it, so it's got a very good history, that conch shell.
Yeah, that's another little thing.
June Appleby, Tregajoran life.
With my Tregajoran life, in my little cottage, it was my birthday one year in June, and I had a lot of friends had come round for a lunch and a little bit of a celebration.
What year was this, do you think, roughly?
Oh, gosh.
80s?
Yes, probably in the 80s, yeah. It was before I went to sea. So late 70s, early 80s. And in the village, there was this really amazing lady called Corrie, who actually had been a midwife and a senior nurse. But she was a very resourceful lady, and she knew that with me, with three kids, or, you know, any offers of fresh food or anything like that, it was great. And she used to supply me with all sorts of stuff. And she'd phone up and say, June, I've got this, I've got that. And I'd pop round and, you know, a crate of tomatoes that were slightly damaged for, you know, for next to nothing. Anyway, this particular day, in the middle of my party, the phone call from Corrie came, and she said, June, she said, I've got some mackerel here, 2 stone of mackerel, she said, and I think it's just right for you. And I said, well, that would be fantastic. She said, well, you've got to, if you want it, you must come for it now. And I said, well, I've got a lot of people here, Corrie. She said, well, it'll have to go because I haven't anywhere to put it. She said, but if you really need to do, come and have it, get it now. So everybody in my house was chattering, having a glass of wine, nibbling away at the food. And I just said, well, look, I won't be long. And I got a friend, dear friend, Geoffrey, and he came with me and with a wheelbarrow. And we went down the lane, the back lane, and picked up all this fish in the wheelbarrow, wheeled it back to my house. And I thought, well, what on earth can we do with this fresh mackerel? And in the end, I managed to get it into my bathroom and put it in the bath, which was... And I had to put a note on the bathroom door to say, you know, this is the bathroom, you know, if you need it, but be prepared for a surprise. And then when the party was over, then I spent the whole evening gutting and, you know, cleaning the fish before I put it in the fridge.
Oh, that was nice. And Corrie kind of looked, I'm just going to add this, is that Corrie kind of looked after us, didn't she? We'd have trays of misshapen eggs and...
Yes, she was brilliant like that. Yeah, you know, she kind was good fun, but it was just...
Helped a struggling one-parent family.
You've got to come now, have the fish now. And, yeah, that reminds me, actually, of also Tregaron thing, and my younger daughter, Genevieve, was studying theatre A-level at Cornwall College, and it was a very theatrical group, and they all came round to my house because they were going to the Penventon to a fancy dress party, and it was linked to, I think, the sinking of the Titanic. There we go, seaside again. And Genevieve had found all these floaty green things, and I'd got some frozen sprats in the freezer, and I said, listen, just to make it look more authentic, Genevieve, that you're lost at sea and you come up through the seaweed, which it looked like she had with all the stuff she'd got round her, I hooked onto her earring a frozen sprat. And not thinking about the fact that when it would defrost, it was going... And she said it was great, and people thought it was very interesting, but she said it suddenly it suddenly defrosted in the middle of the fancy dress party. So...
Oh,
yeah.
Dear Jen.
Electric
screen. No, it's not. So I interrupted June just because I knew another story was coming. So this is about water. Why do you like to be near water?
Yes. My father managed swimming pools in Surrey, and there were 2 pools, and we lived on site. So I grew up with water until he retired. You know, and then we lived by the River Thames, so a lot of our leisure time was spent on the river. We went for a camping holiday in a punt, very much like 3 men in a boat, my mother and father and my brother and myself. That was a great time, very funny time. And then later on, as I say, I came down to St Ives, and I live near the sea now. But then for 16 years, I worked as a librarian and bookshop manager on the QE2 and was at sea for 16 years. So I just can't keep away from water. And I will never leave Cornwall now.
Have you got any other QE2 stories?
Oh, yes. We've got this very week, actually. The tall ships are in Falmouth. And decades ago, when I was on the QE2, we actually anchored off Falmouth during the tall ships in Falmouth. And I knew Tim Hubbard, who was one of Radio Cornwall's journalists, and so I got in touch through the radio room on the ship, and I phoned Tim, and I said, Tim, I'm in the library on the ship looking across at Falmouth and all the wonderful ships. And so he arranged to phone me in the library, and I was interviewed on Radio Cornwall talking about, you know, being on the ship and being with the tour ships. And then a friend of mine was on the headland. I didn't know this because all the people had come on the headland to look across places like Flushing and that. And they said that people had their radios on. And he said, suddenly I heard your voice. And he said, and I didn't know. I was looking around for you and it was me on the radio. So, but that was, we did some amazing things on the ship like that. So I was just, when I having a piece of cake here in the library made by a lovely chef, and it was Japanese cheesecake, and I told him about the period we were in Japan on the ship for 6 months. So I'm very, very fortunate. I've sailed the world, been round the world, must be about 5 times. And here I am now talking to my daughter.
Ingrid Ruth.
I don't know what to say.
Bye.